So yesterday I was at Leisure World, Seal Beach, California, and speaking to the Buddhist Club in Playhouse Number 3. Well, actually, it's Clubhouse Number 3, but they play there too. And we had some questions that were asked, and I thought it was interesting that I bring them up. But before I bring those questions up, last week I was invited by a retirement community in Florida to talk about my book. They have a reading club, a book club, and all the members read my book and they all had questions. Of course. And you might be saying, well, Kusla, what book do you have? And it's called Urban Dharma, 20 Years of Buddhist Stories from an LA City Monk. And it talks about my community service in Los Angeles, 20 years of community service. And so it was fun. A lot of the questions were about me and why I became a monk and what do you do and where do you live and all that kind of stuff. And then they had some questions about the book as well. So it was a wonderful hour I spent with them on Zoom. We had a Zoom meeting. And it's just amazing now with the technology that we have that I don't have to go anywhere. I can just stay in my room forever and talk to the world. Then, during the talk yesterday in Seal Beach, a woman said, "You know, I did the 12-step program for a while when I was younger. And in the 12-step program, they ask for a higher power. They ask you to take on a higher power to guide you and help you and things like that." And she said, "Does Buddhism have a higher power?" Because if you know anything about Buddhism, the Buddha was a man. He was a woke man. Sorry. And so he wasn't a god, you know, he wasn't, you know, a guru. He was a guy that woke up. So do you have higher power in Buddhism? And I said, yes, we do. We call it wisdom and compassion. And they went, really? I said, yeah. If you have wisdom and compassion, that's all the power you ever need. So with that, the next question was, I'm new to meditation. I'm not quite sure what meditation is all about. Can you enlighten me about meditation? I said, I can't enlighten you, but I'll give you my opinion. And they said, okay. I said, in Buddhism, we have two kinds of meditation. We have insight meditation and we have tranquility meditation, which is called samatha. Insight meditation, there are four different kinds of insight meditation that you can do. Samatha meditation, tranquility meditation, there are 40, 40 different kinds of meditation that you can do. The Buddha, before he was the Buddha and was Siddhartha, went into the jungles and forests of India to study with the mendicants, the ascetics, the gurus, to find out about meditation. At that time, everybody was doing samatha meditation. And nobody was doing insight meditation. So the Buddha went through all the different kinds of tranquility meditation and realized there was one big problem. The problem was it didn't last forever. That once your meditation was over, all the aspects of tranquility meditation faded away. He wanted to find a permanent solution. He rediscovered insight meditation. I use the word rediscovered because, according to some Buddhist traditions, he was the 28th Buddha. There were 27 Buddhists before him who all rediscovered insight meditation, which led to their nirvana. So the Buddha did, Siddhartha did tranquility meditation. rediscovered insight meditation and became liberated, became the Buddha, one who is awake. So let's talk about Samatha meditation first. It is a tranquility and concentration exercise that you find an object of meditation, and there are a variety of objects you can use. When I started meditating in 1979, in this very room, right here, a rainy night, it was cold. They didn't turn on the heater. They said, your cushion is right over there. And after the hour of meditation, Shinzen, the teacher, will come and give a Dharma talk. I sat down on the hard floor, unforgiving. I became chilled, wondering why the hell didn't they turn on the heater? Were they saving energy? Were they saving money? I sat that hour and never suffered as much as I have the rest of my life. In that 1 hour, the knees hurt, the ankles hurt, the back hurt, the mind was agitated. I couldn't figure out why anybody would want to do this. What could it possibly lead to besides insanity? But I came back the next week because Shinzen gave the best darn Dharma talk. It was wonderful. He's now 80 years old, and he's going to retire from giving talks. He's going to be retired from being a teacher and do other stuff. And I thought to myself, wow, I was lucky that I found him. I was lucky that I found this place, because this place encouraged Westerners to come and learn about Buddhism. Shinzen was a nice Jewish guy from LA, going to UCLA, who went to Japan to study Japanese culture and history, found a Shingon temple, and became ordained as a monk. And when he came back to the States, this is where he stayed. He was given a room. He was a teacher, and for a while, he was even vice abbot of the center. So let's get back to meditation. So I sat, I suffered, I sat, I suffered, I sat, I suffered. I just couldn't figure out how not to suffer. And what did the Buddha say? He said, I only teach two things. I teach why we suffer. I teach how to end that suffering. In his 45 years of teaching, those are the only two things he ever talked about, in 1,000 different ways, depending on the audience he was talking to. So there I sat, watching my breath. And you say to yourself, it probably wasn't cold enough to see your breath. How can you watch your breath? You bring your mind, you bring your attention to the tip of the nose and feel the sensation of breath going out and coming in, going out and coming in. Now, there were other techniques of watching the breath, but that's the one that I used. And then I realized that I was not in charge, because my mind kept going in all these different places, thinking about what I was going to eat after I got out of this meditation place, thinking about the ride home, will the traffic be good or bad, thinking about the laundry I need to do next week. All these thoughts kept arising. And I kept trying to bring my attention to the tip of the nose and feel that sensation of breath going out and coming in, going out and coming in. Then somebody said, try counting. Try attaching a number to the breath and go from 1 to 10 and 10 to 1. 1 to 10 and 10 to 1. If you lose your place, you go back to 1. So I did that. 1. 2, 3, I wonder what's on TV. Oh, 1, 2, back to 1. That's what I call my meditation practice. What kind of meditation you do? I practice back to 1. Okay. I got better though. It took time. It took a long time. And then I became aware of the jhanas, the 5 jhanas. Jhanas. Look it up on Google. It'll give you an idea of what this meditation is all about. So each, the first jhana has five characteristics: applied thought, sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. So I said, well, what does that mean? How can I apply that to my meditation practice? And then I asked around and I found a book, and it finally became a little more clear. Applied thought to sustained thought. You bring your attention to the tip of your nose and you hold it there. Applied thought and sustained thought. That's the first two characteristics. The next characteristic is happiness, and then we get into bliss, and then we get into equanimity. So the first jhana has five characteristics. I got pretty good at applying my thought, holding it there. I slipped in to the second jhana. Happiness, bliss, and equanimity. I said, oh, this is cool. I love this. I don't want any more insight. I don't want to understand everything completely. I want to be happy and ignorant and blissful and joyful. And if I know everything, I'll never be those things. So I continued with my happiness, bliss, and equanimity, and I came to realize that happiness is dualistic. You just can't stay in happiness because happiness is connected to sadness, and it's going to change. The Buddha warned us. Everything's impermanent. Nothing lasts forever, especially if it's dualistic. So I said, how can I get rid of my happiness in order to get rid of my sadness so I won't have that? I figured out a way. I can't tell you because it's my way, but you all have your way. And you'll find your way if you apply yourself to it. So now I went into the third jhana, bliss, equanimity. Now, bliss is pleasure. It's physical pleasure. Happiness is mental happiness, mental sadness. But now I'm in this place of physical pleasure. My whole body is tingling. I'm going, oh man, this is cool. I'm going to meditate every day now. I want to be here as much as I can. No drugs involved. It's just rapture of the body, just tingling, just oozing with physical pleasure. Ah, it's dualistic as well, because the opposite of physical pleasure is physical pain. And I experienced that the first years of my meditation practice, that physical pain. It took a long time to get to this place of physical pleasure. But I'm leaving myself open for disappointment because the pain is sure to arise again. Now I got to figure out a way to let go of that pleasure and let go of the aversion to pain. I figured it out. I can't tell you because it's my way, but you can figure it out yourself. Now I slipped into the fourth jhana. Only one characteristic left. Equanimity, perfect balance. No left, no right, always in the middle. No attachment, no aversion, always in the middle. Ultimate relative peace. Now, this may come as a disappointment to some of you, but the goal of meditation and the goal of Buddhism is peace. It's not happiness. It's not joy. It's not pleasure. It's peace, profound peace. And that's how nirvana is often described. Okay. Then the gong rang. I wasn't upset because I had equanimity. And everybody stretched their legs, stood up, ventured out into the LA environment to drive home on the 405 or the 101. And I learned a big lesson that everything I experienced came from within. Nothing out there triggered it. It came from within. And what do they tell us to do as we grow up and mature and become adults? They tell us to look out and grab the reality that's apparent. Good job, good relationship, nice car, great food. All that stuff is outside us. It's not inside us. And we're always striving to put all that stuff inside us and can't do it. So we're always ultimately disappointed with the world because the world can't make us any better. But we, with our practice, can make the world better. We can invest our time and energy into making a difference. That's what the book Urban Dharma is all about. I got lucky. I got invited to help the world be a better place. And I took advantage of it. And of course, being a monk, they didn't have to pay me. I was free. And so I would show up, I would do my magic, which is just showing up. And that was how it evolved into a 20-year practice of community service. But it all started because I sat on a cushion on a cold, rainy night in Koreatown, trying to learn how to meditate and realizing that life is full of suffering, always has been, always will be. So now we get into the second kind of meditation that the Buddha rediscovered, insight meditation, with the four qualities: mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental objects, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations. I'm going to talk about mindfulness of sensations because for me, that was the easiest to understand. The Buddha said we have three sensations that we can become aware of: good sensations, bad sensations, and neutral sensations. But the problem with neutral sensations is they generally don't catch our attention. We miss them. But we do pick up on the pleasant sensations and the unpleasant sensations. So they have a technique called body scanning. And you would start at the top of your head and go to the tip of your toes, and you would take your awareness and just scan up and down, up and down, up and down. And as soon as you found a sensation, as soon as you became aware of a sensation, you'd stop and note it. You wouldn't say great sensation, bad, you just say sensation. Okay? And then you'd continue. And then you'd find another sensation. Okay, another sensation. Got that? Then you'd find another sensation. And to be honest with you, when I tried to do that, most of my sensations were negative. I couldn't find any of the positive sensations that I found in my Samatha tranquility meditation. I just found the sensations of the body sitting on a cold, hard floor. Those were sort of unpleasant, but I noted them. Now, the idea is to use all those sensations you became aware of and apply them to three aspects of Buddhism: anicca, dukkha, anatta. Impermanence, suffering, not self. Okay. So, and speaking of impermanence, what happened last night at 2 o'clock in the morning? We changed our clocks. Why do we have time? We invented time because we wanted to keep track of the impermanence of the world. If it's 12 o'clock, it must be time for lunch. If I'm eating lunch, then it must be 12 o'clock. Shunryu Suzuki, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I read that, I said, wow, that is so cool. It doesn't have to be 12 o'clock if you're eating lunch, because eating lunch means it's 12 o'clock. Those Zen guys, they're so into it. Okay, so now we've got all these sensations, and I'm going to apply the sensations to anicca, impermanent. Did I find any of these sensations that didn't change? And you know, they always changed. Sometimes they got worse, sometimes they got less worse. They were always worse, but less worse. And I thought back to my motorcycle trip, Los Angeles to Wisconsin and back, 5,000 miles on two wheels, balancing all the way. And during that motorcycle trip, there were times when my bladder started to pulsate with pain and fullness. And I said, okay, I can make it to the next town. It's not that far away. I know I can do it. Did that sensation stay the same? No, it always got worse. Why did it get worse? It wanted my attention. It was saying to me, Kusla, you need to do something about this, man. You just can't have a full bladder and not do anything about it. Finally, the rest area. Ah, sensation changed from pain to pleasure. Okay, always changing, never the same, always different. Those roads in Arizona, asphalt, smooth as glass. What a joy that was. Those roads in Minnesota, made out of cement because of the winters, like going through rocks. Terrible. Man, always changing and didn't stay the same very long at all. What I found in my meditation practice, I could apply to the world around me and have that insight and gain that wisdom into the true nature of the world. Okay, now we come to the second aspect, which is dukkha, which is unsatisfactoriness, which is suffering, but sometimes it's just a little suffering and not a big suffering. Did everything I realized in my meditation practice have suffering connected to it? Did it come out of suffering? Was it always suffering? Well, applying impermanence to it wasn't always suffering. No, that's true. Sometimes the suffering lessened, sometimes there was more, but the underlying reality of those sensations was always the potential for suffering. It was always there. Okay. So the Buddha said, you know, it's an unsatisfactory life that we have. It's a miracle. It's a miracle we're all here. What are the chances that we would make it? And I'm not talking just about this Sunday, I'm talking about living. If you're a Christian, this is the first time you've ever been here. If you're a Hindu or a Buddhist, I say, welcome back. Where have you been? Can you imagine never having been here before? And now you get 60 or 70 years of joyful playfulness on this planet we call Earth. And then you have to leave. And leaving is always physically and emotionally difficult. It's never good. It's never good. And then you never come back again. That was it. That was the miracle, those 70 years. Never take your life for granted. Never take today for granted. This is the best day you're ever going to have. This is the only day you're ever going to have. We only do it once, and it keeps happening over and over again. One day every day. Man. Okay, so suffering, yeah. It's there. We can minimize it. The practice of Buddhism and the Eightfold Path allows us to suffer less, less, and less until eventually we don't have to suffer ever again. That was the Buddha's contribution to religion, is he could teach us how never to have to suffer again and never have to be reborn again. You Hindus, Hindus, and Buddhists, all the Christians, they're taken care of. They got a place to go and things to do. But the Buddhists and the Hindus, we keep coming back over and over again to suffer and suffer and die and die and suffer and die. And the Buddha said, I can fix that. I figured it out. I don't teach you how not to die. I teach you how not to be reborn. Ooh. That's a trip, isn't it? How not to be reborn? Okay. Three, not self. Not self. What does that mean? That our self doesn't exist? No, we have a self and it does exist. But we are not that self. What are we? Who are we? Famous Zen koan, who am I? Well, somebody came up with the answer saying, I think, therefore I am. But that's not good enough because don't believe everything you think. It's just thoughts. That's it. It's just thoughts. Okay, so now we try to figure out, well, what am I? What did the Buddha say about us? We're the five aggregates: form, sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. We're the five aggregates. Or we're mind and body. We're two. The Buddha said we are never one. Wow. I had a woman yesterday in Seal Beach say, can you tell me about oneness? Do you have oneness in Buddhism? And do you have cause in Buddhism? Do you have a first cause in Buddhism? I said, no, we do not have oneness. We are not all one. She recoiled in terror. We're not one. We're not all one. We're not collectively just part of the same group or tribe. We're not all one. I said, yes, we are all together, but not because of oneness, because of connectedness. We're all connected. If you only have oneness, you're asking uniformity to show its ugly head. If you have interconnectedness, you have a certain level of independence, individuality, but it's still connected to everything else. So the Buddha was trying to tell us in this not self concept that we really do not exist independently and nothing in us exists independently either. And she said, well, how about the soul? The soul exists independently, does it? I said, well, the Buddha said we may not have a soul. She gasped. Really? I said, yeah. He said, you know, he hasn't been able to locate it. And in the 1920s, when they invented the X-ray machine, they started X-raying people to look for the soul. Couldn't find it. But they did give a lot of people radiation poisoning. Then they said, well, we'll find the soul and we'll weigh it. We'll weigh somebody before they die and we'll weigh somebody after they die. And the difference in weight will be the weight of the soul. Well, it was a good idea, but it didn't work because the body often releases fluids and other stuff, and so the weight changes after death anyway. So what does that mean to us? Well, for me, having been born in Iowa and raised a Lutheran for a while, that it's okay if you want to have a soul, and it's okay if you want to have a self, but that's not who you really are. According to Buddhism, that's not who you really are. And if you follow Zen at all and watch all those Zen koans and who am I really, and you come up with mu, which is one of the answers, you know, it's we are not relatively real. We are ultimately real. Okay? And what that means is we're sort of like, I'll use the word spirit, even though the spirits in Buddhism are a little different than the spirits in other religions. It's a spirit pretending it's a human being. It's an ultimate reality pretending it's a relative reality. And we can blame our parents because they gave us life. And then they sent us to school. I mean, I hated school. From kindergarten on, never liked school, never liked the pressure, never wanted to be around all these people I didn't know. Realizing, of course, that I was being socialized. And it was important to be socialized and understand my place in this community. You know, so I kept going back to school, but I kept getting all these concepts and all these ideas, and it prevented me from seeing the reality of my life. I just couldn't see the form called a chair. When I saw the form, I said, that's a chair. A chair is just a sound or a couple letters creating a word. It doesn't exist. We are all in conspiracy to make that chair exist. If I say the word chair, in your mind, you might picture a different chair than I'm picturing. Everybody might have their own special chair, just from that word. Who do we blame? Education. They educated us not to see the world around us. We only see what they told us to see. Good chair, bad chair. Healthy tree, sick tree. It's a tree. And it's not even a tree, it's just a form with color and sensation and touch and weight and all these things. And we're living in this amazing hallucination. It boggles my mind that anybody would ever want to try LSD. This is the biggest and best trip you're ever going to have. This is your life. Wake up. Enjoy it. Marvel at it. Be impressed by it. Never take it for granted. So this insight meditation leads us to look at the world in a radically different way. And eventually, it leads us down the path to liberation. And we will be free. Not in the relative sense of freedom. We'll be free from the relative sense of freedom. We will be living in the ultimate experience. And every time we get stopped by the police and they ask us for our driver's license, we go from the ultimate experience to the relative reality of having to be somebody and having to have insurance and a license. You can't tell them, I'm the ultimate reality. They won't buy it. They'll take you in for observation, hospital number 4. Okay, meditation is a way to change your mind. Meditation is a way to change your life. It's getting close to the end of my time. I want to thank you for listening intently. And I hope some of you understood what I was saying. And I hope if you didn't understand what I was saying, you'll go and find out what the heck I was saying and see if it works for you.